This is an unscripted audio recording by Peter Taylor on the topic Nature versus Nurture versus Nature versus Nurture. This talk is inspired by hearing Anne Fausto Sterling speak at the Science for the People 1970s and Today conference in mid-April in Amherst, Massachusetts, which followed shortly after her publication in the Boston Review, an online source, of a particular blog post about how human children come to walk at different ages, in different cultures, in different circumstances. Let me backtrack a little bit. I came to see that Anne is trying to get beyond critique of saying, you know, these people keep bringing up nature's dominant over nurture, to get beyond critique and to propose alternatives that help, better explanations, that help explain things. And her focus is on developmental biology. So a good starting point to think about her opposition of nature versus nurture, which in the end you'll see is different from my opposition, is to think about the claim that some behavior is innate. That claim is really not an explanation. It's really just an invitation or a shifting of the terms of the explanation. Yep. If it turns out that every bird that hatches out of the egg does, let's think about the Lorenz's geese. You know, follow Lorenz. You know, that they just follow the moving larger object when they when they're little ducklings, little goslings. We might say that's innate, but we still have to understand, or we might be interested to understand, how they got to be an organism that could take that information, big moving object, and turn it into the following action. But some of you might say, I don't really care. As long as they always do it, then there's that's the important thing. There's no way it can be changed. In an earlier blog post of Anne's, she talks about some work where, if I recall it, anyway, the point is there, that little mouse pups, when they're born, they crawl up their mother to a nipple. So that seems innate. They always do it. But some people did this experiment where the mother mice were fed peppermint, I believe, which is quite sharp taste. And so the little, in utero, the little pups were used to that. And then when the pups were born, if there was a trail with peppermint in it that led away from the mother's nipples, then the little pups went towards that. So they weren't, the behavior wasn't innately, unchangeably, let's crawl towards nipples, which seems to be a good functional thing to do. It actually had some chemical cues they had to respond to. Okay, so you could then say, but how do they respond to the chemical cues that they've received in utero? So that seems innate. But you get the point that you begin to, two points, you begin to open it up, so you have to say, how does it actually happen mechanistically? How does it happen developmentally that these pups crawl to the nipples? And you see that it's made of pieces that have to be put together, or can be put together, to be understood. And when you put together those pieces, you begin to see ways that it could go in different directions. You might say, well, there's no mouse pup I know that's taking in peppermint, so this is just an experiment. So in the natural world, it will always go that way. But the natural world has its own variabilities, and particularly when you think about how evolutionary changes happen over time, those variabilities can get drawn upon, can be the source of new directions in an evolutionary lineage. You might still say, but you know, if I want to think about human behavioral traits, well, here we go. You want to think about human behavioral traits, and you want to suggest that the environment is as fixed as it is normally for mice in a laboratory. That seems a little unlikely. So Anne's program is to get you to think about the way development happens in an individual lifetime, and always try to unpack it and put it back together in a developmental system, so that we can both understand what often happens, even always happens, but then see the opportunities for change. So in the case of walking, it turns out that babies who have been put on their stomach in cribs, you know, because the word got out in North America, at least, probably other advanced countries, that it was that you had to put the babies on the back. When you put them on the front, they had a greater chance, it was still small, but a greater chance of SIDS, sudden infant death. But those babies who were always put on their back walked later, which doing things later for a baby always seems to parents and pediatricians as delayed, retarded, that there's a problem there, rather than just it's different. But when people tried to piece it together, they saw that the babies on their stomachs were doing much more, like pushing themselves up and building particular muscles, neck and shoulder muscles, that were very helpful in getting to be able to walk. So they ended up walking earlier. And it turns out that babies carried around on women's backs, seems to be always the women, not the men who carry them around. You might think swaddled up, that would retard walking, but instead it doesn't. Seems that all the jostling and the pushing that a baby can do in its swaddled situation actually lead to it being more likely to walk earlier. Anyway, so Anne's looking at these early childhood things, and she's also very interested in the ones that lead children to develop a sense of a stereotypical gender identity, and to consider how much external interaction channels gender into two particularly dominant channels. Okay, so this is a view that's trying to get beyond nature versus nurture, in the sense of saying, you know, in order to be able to walk, all sorts of things are happening in the body, but they're happening in a particular environment, and it's not just how much environment versus how much is inborn. It's just a different question. How does this develop? You know, it's saying, I'm never really interested in simply saying something's innate. I want to understand how it develops. But this is a different nature versus nurture to the one that many people have been interested in and been interested in critiquing. That's the one of IQ studies of heritability. Heritability sounds like it's to do with genes being passed on from parent to offspring, but it's actually a statistical term which can be the statistic can be estimated from data on observed traits. You might know nothing about genes being transmitted. You can even estimate heritability when there are no genes transmitted, but that's I won't go into that. It's kind of obscure cases, just to make a conceptual point. But that nature versus nurture, when people say IQ test scores are 60% heritable at whatever it is, age 20, they're not looking at an individual developing. They're not looking at how are genes and environmental cues tied together in a developmental system to produce the outcome. They know nothing about that. They're looking at observed traits, and in particular, so you can conceptualize it, they're looking at identical twins and lots of sets of identical twins and comparing it with lots of sets of fraternal twins. Now, fraternal twins don't share as many of their genes as identical twins, which share all their genes, even though there's some small differences in how those genes are turned on and activated in even at an early stage. But let's say the identical twins share all their genes and fraternal twins don't. So if it turns out when you look over all the sets of identical twins that one twin is similar to the other to a certain degree in, say, height at, say, age 20, and the fraternal, you look at the same similarity between twin 1 and twin 2 over all the sets for fraternal twins and find that they're less similar, then it's a reasonable thing to say that the identical twins are more similar because they share more of their genes. This is assuming that the for each twin pair they get raised in the same family, and it's putting aside the objections that identical twins are treated more equally than fraternal twins. There'd be people who say we shouldn't do that. But just to make the point, here we're looking at, and the extra similarity of the identical twins compared to the fraternal twins is basically the heritability, or, you know, you can connect it with formulas. And if it turned out that the identical twins weren't any more similar than fraternal twins, the heritability would be zero. That wouldn't say there are no genes involved. It would just say there's nothing extra special about this, the situation of genes and environment in development for these identical twins versus the fraternal twins. But you see, it's a different, when you get these estimates, it's a different sense of nature versus nurture. When you get the estimates and you find out that, say, height is 80, the heritability is 80%, that's translated by people into the idea that it's 80% nurture, 20%, 80% nature, 20% nurture. I told you this was unscripted. And the nurture might even include sort of randomness and so on. So listening to Anne's talk made me realize there are two kind of battles going on here. And the interesting thing to me is that if you conflate the two battles, what you're doing is in fact undermining the second battle. The second battle being to question these heritability estimates and to question the way they're interpreted, because it suggests that heritability is about genes and environment development, when in fact it's about the observed traits, and it's just a promise that sometime we'll be able to connect those to genes. And let me just suggest why that promise is rarely fulfilled and unlikely to be filled. Because when I told you the story, the situation about monozygote twins versus fraternal twins, and I said the monozygote twins are more similar because they share more of their genes than the fraternal twins, but there's nothing in the analysis of traits, for example, the height or the IQ test score, that says the genes that the first pair of monozygote twins share are the same genes that the second monozygote twins share, are the same genes that the third monozygote twins share. There's nothing in the method that can tell whether that is, because there's nothing in the method that depends on knowing what those genes are, or being able to point to what they are, to tell you what they are, so you can check whether they're the same genes. Moreover, there's nothing in the analysis which says that the environment, that the monozygote twin, the first pair of monozygote twins experience as they develop in one of Ann Foster-Sterling's developmental systems is the same set of environmental cues as the second pair of monozygotic twins share. This is what I call the possibility of underlying heterogeneity of genetic and environmental factors. And that possibility is always there in the method. So I'm pushing at the second battle, the second nature-nurture battle, by trying to get people to see that the method doesn't translate into genes and environmental factors and opens up and has the possibility that those factors are heterogeneous, that one person's height has happened through a different developmental sequence from another person's height. And the importance of that is that knowing heritability is then a very poor guide to two things. One is which traits we should focus on when we're searching for the underlying genetic factors. And secondly, the idea that something with a high heritability is difficult to change. That's a well-known point, that genetic doesn't mean unchangeable, but it's played out in a different way when you tackle the second nature-nurture than when you tackle Ann Foster-Sterling's nature-nurture. So I hope this unscripted little talk is interesting enough for any of you who are still listening, and I look forward to your responses. And I'll just say one last thing. The reason I'm doing it in this unscripted way is in a busy life, I can just see myself never getting around to typing this up. So I thought, well, I'll at least get it out of my system and maybe someone will listen to it. So thank you for listening this far.